there was this question of the delay times, and you had a certain profile which you had on this the binary population synthesis. I mean, this is one from I don't like that. No way. This is the one from the Podsiadlovsky group and about the double degenerates. You see they start very early, 50 million years after the star burst, you get them, and they peak at about 100 million years, and then they go down by a factor of 100 in 10 billion years. And I had the feeling that it did not look that different from what you showed. You had a somewhat higher peak at the beginning and then it flattened out, but in my opinion that does not make much of a difference. This is a double degenerate. The single degenerate is this one, but that is more uncertain, I would think.
Could you sketch what kind of systems are merging at early times and at late times?
I think it's the massive white dwarfs, of course, which are merging at the early times.
So these are mergers of two detached white dwarfs, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this is from this population synthesis program which Philip Podsiadlovsky has engineered with Rappaport and other people in the past. And they have certain assumptions in there. There is a lot of stuff in these programs, of course, a lot of input going in. You have to assume something of the initial distribution of mass ratios of the binaries. You have to put in an IMF and all these type of things. You have to assume something about the common envelope phase, etc., etc.
But is there a physical reason why there's kind of like a change of 1 giga-year, where it's kind of going down fast and then it flattens out a little for the DD scenario?
Not really, no. Let's look.
Well, that's all common, I mean.
Yeah, it's in the common envelope type of things. So those are the ones which finish up with wider orbits, clearly. So they take a longer time to merge. But yeah, that's, I think it has to do with all the assumptions in the common.
But the other question that always comes up is that in the two galaxies nearby, or even out to redshift point five, we know that basically for most of those, the stellar population was put in place at in the redshift of 1. So the age is 5, 6, 7 giga-years. So that I think
it must be then in this area.
Well, there's only one. I mean, as far as I know, there's only one physical scenario that can do this at 7 giga-years.
Yeah, if there was not a little galaxy from time to time falling into the elliptical galaxy, if there were not from time to time little galaxies falling into the elliptical, so that you could have from time to time some little bit of star formation.
The challenge we've got is being able to eliminate any scenario.
Yeah.
Right? Not that we have a shortage of scenarios. It would be nice to actually say one of these is irrelevant.
Yeah.
So the question is, what's the most extreme cell population we come up with? Well, that's in
ellipticals. Well, that is the big problem with the ellipticals. You know, in the beginning, people thought there is no star, has not been any star formation the last 10 to 10 years or 5 times 10 to 9 years. But yeah, nowadays, always people do find from time to time here and there in an elliptical some evidence for stuff.
Okay, so I guess the physics question is, at 10 giga years, how do you make a type wave if it's 10 giga years after a starburst?
Oh, the only way is by double degenerate.
Okay, I'd like to comment on
that. Oh, okay. You, okay. No. Yeah, you're right. Of course, you can do it with symbiotics also. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that this model, I have to go back to the people because I don't recall exactly what they were doing, but this looks like the close binary super soft source model.
Okay. This is the super soft. These are the super softs. Yeah.
Well, anything that works, if it's an accreting white dwarf, will be super soft, whether or not you see the X-ray radiation. Any single model needs to be burning. But I guess what I would say is that...
So at 10 giga-years.
Well, okay, I also want to When the turnoff mass is 0.8, you can still have giants. It depends on what you call symbiotic. I mean, many people refer to the wind loss.
But you can't make a super soft source at that time.
Why not?
Suppose you have a 1.3 solar mass white dwarf with a 1 solar mass companion who becomes a red giant in a symbiotic, like what?
Well, you're saying wind accretion. When I hear super soft, I think thermal time scale mass transfer.
Okay. Well,
that's, I think, the problem. I think super soft just means a.
What's the business of mass transfer?
But the winds are very slow, so you can capture a very large part of the wind. This is probably what Roseanne means to say.
We have a rotational filling situation. The time scale in this case is basically R over R dash, where R is the radius of the star and R dash is its time derivative.
But these things do not come out of these things which you are talking about do not come out of these population synthesis. I mean, Lev has looked at it. I mean, here I give the other version. This is the Russian version of the same diagram, which is from a few years before, but it has basically the same features. He starts with the double degenerate at 30 million years instead of 50 million years. Posidlovsky started. And they peak at the same time, at 10 to the 8 years, the double degenerates. And also they go down by a factor of 100 in 10 to the 10 years. So these two diagrams look really the same for the double degenerates. The single degenerate, the super soft, the peak is much lower, factor 5. I've told this already many times, I think, when I was giving talks about these type of things, and Lebro has told it also.
So that also only has one channel at 10 gigahertz.
Yes, because in his models where he also takes the symbiotics, but I don't know how accurately that all has been done, but his feeling is that the symbiotics couldn't do very much, actually. But, yeah, that's... you know the paper, huh? I think. In the mid-90s they had this paper where they also included the symbiotics. And there the white dwarf masses in general are rather low in the symbiotics, the distribution of the white dwarf masses, which they get from their simulations. They have pretty low white dwarf masses, so it would be pretty hard to crank them up to the Chandrasekhar limit, I would think.
Right, but if I wanted to paint everybody into a corner, right, I say, fine, use symbiotics, but then the problem is you now have this exploding air red giant, which we probably all know. And we all know these other talks, there's no hydrogen, and it's very constraining on the red giant scenario.
Yeah, but that's this Arizona paper where they try to see how much hydrogen you could still...
It's very easy if it's a red giant because there's almost no binding.
And now I put them both together, actually. This was my one graph, which I wanted to show. So I would say for the double degenerate scenario, both of them are really remarkably similar. Jungelsen et al. Start 30 million years in the Podzielowski
group. Because they have the same common envelope description.
They don't have the same common envelope. The Russian have a slightly different common envelope prescription than the Western people. And there are, their program in total is very different. I think they use different types of evolutionary tracks Podzielowski has basically the German, the Kippenhahn type of evolution, and the Russians have the Paczynski type of evolution. But it all basically comes down to the same. And Lev pointed out to me why his peak for the single degenerates is a factor 5 lower than theirs. He thinks that their assumptions are too rough in their calculations.
So, Lars, how about these ellipticals are, the population, the normal 1As you see in ellipticals are a prompt population from some contamination of young stars, and then the old population, and there is some, are all 91 BG likes and yep. completely different.
Yep, I think that's an interesting hypothesis. It's completely testable for everything we know. You could either rule it out or not.
Could you jack up?
Right, that's what they said, 91 BG.
It's subluminous.
It's
subluminous in the fast decliner.
Okay.
And other than that,
you're already in old population.
Yeah.
You only see it in the old population.
I think that's a pretty safe statement.
Yeah.
5% confidence. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think you could say, so Peter, you could test that hypothesis, right? Because we know the rate of star formation in nearby ellipticals. And if you peg the 1A rate, the star formation rate, as you see in spirals, and assume it's the same in ellipticals, then you could run the exercise through and see if you can explain the 1A ellipticals that way.
Yeah.
How much star formation you would need to explain.
That's right.
Right.
And I think I know the answer. So good luck.
I think you could hide some star formation, and the fact that the problem seems to be 100 times that of the late. It doesn't take that much star formation to give you enough supernova.
And the observations also give this factor 100, more or less.
Yeah, the SNLS result is about a factor.
You've got to explain why the stretch distribution is different.
For the prompt population.
Yeah.
That's another problem.
No, I mean, it's a good exercise. That would be really interesting. I mean, if you have enough data, you can actually...
But would these profiles still fit with your observations?
Not really. You need more signal at the in the short evolution time. I mean, you need... Yes. 50% of supernovae should occur before...
Yeah, but this is a logarithmic problem.
Yes,
I cannot really see it on a logarithmic scale whether this is right or not.
What? We do some models on observations. Qualitatively, it's okay, but still, they cannot reproduce the problem.
Hmm.
But I think there is another binary scenario that's missing from this. So I'm complaining because there are two scenarios that are missing from here. One of them is prompt for single degenerates, and one of them is delayed. Now, first, to address the symbiotic question,
yeah.
We know very few white dwarfs in binaries that are around 1.3 solar masses. But we know two of them.
And they are in symbiotics.
Yes. Yes. So
how do you know those masses?
Well, because of the frequency of the return, they're not yet. I mean, they're working on that. And I know their oxygen neon. But also their temperature, etc. And the maybe their oxygen neon. They very well could be. But the point is that, you know, if you have a neutral star, oxygen neon, I tend to actually think this light that these particular ones are. But if they are oxygen neon, that's not to say that if you just had a white dwarf with a slightly smaller mass, the sort of a slightly smaller mass, that population shouldn't be missing. You know, that if you're seeing the extreme of the population, whatever the composition of the white dwarf, speaks for a population that continues down to the initial white dwarf mass that was somewhat lower. So I think the observations tell us that certainly you can have more massive light dwarfs and symbiotics. And I think the problem with these population synthesis is that they considered only a certain range of binary parameters. So you can go, but certainly there's nothing that says you couldn't have an evolved solar mass star, for example, that ends up filling its Roche low and donating on the nuclear time scale.
I think for the symbiotics that the Jungelsen group was the only one who did also simulation, and they assumed just wind, I think, and no Roche low power.
But Roche low
overflow
is certainly something that we expect to have.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I think the simulation have considered a limited range on both the prompt side and the delay side.
But there is an implication if you want to get the symbiotic channel at 10 to the 10 gigahertz, mm-hmm. Sorry, 10 to the 10 years. That means that you have to start out with a mass ratio which is quite extreme. because you do need to get the 1.2 or 1.3 total mass star from an 8 total mass star or 7 total mass star. And you need that in a binary, which is relatively wide, where you only have a 0.8 total mass star that only starts to fill the first level after 10 years. So the question is, are the constraints on the mass ratio, the initial mass ratio distribution, already that strict that you can rule out? I mean, I don't know exactly what they are. That you, do you make these extreme binaries? Yes or no? That, I mean,
I think that's a gray area, because you would have to start with a wide system, a very wide system, in order to have it finish, say, like with a period of 100 days later. So you have to start out, so you probably would have to have the common envelope only on the asymptotic giant branch, and there the atmosphere is very fluffy, so you don't spiral in very deeply. So yeah, it seems reasonable, but I think that's an area where people really don't know much about the mass ratio distribution.
Right, because we have to look at very wide transceivers, where the one is 7 or 8 total mass.
And the other is 1.
The other is 0.8 or 1 or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, already the difference in luminosity between these makes it difficult to find.
Yeah, but... But look at Sirius. Systems like that apparently exist in nature. I mean, the white dwarf in Sirius must have been 5 or 6 solar masses originally.
But the other one is 2 solar masses. I mean, it's an A or like that. Yeah. So I mean, it's not extreme enough.
Yeah.
But in these calculations, you know, these systems are not at all considered.
I think.
Well, apparently, there's something in the prescription.
It may not be refined enough. These simulations may not be refined enough to really make.
You. I don't remember though this one issue. Did they actually include the Roche-Loeb filling wider system? I don't think so. You have certain branches. You say start with a binary, and then you're always branching. And certain branches, you say, oh, that's not interesting anymore. And you follow the ones that you think are interesting.
I think they follow all of them, isn't it? They should follow. I think they follow all of them, all the branches.
Well, then you would have Roche-Loeb filling lighter.
Yeah,
if you follow them.
But they last very short, I think. They last very short.
That's true. But not necessarily shorter than, say, for close binary super solid sources. You have to get a few tenths of a solar mass.
So you want to do a 0.8 on a 1, which is stable.
It's stable, basically.
And you use the R dot just from the shell branch.
Oh, no, that could last 10 to the 8 years, actually. Yeah. Yeah, it's a giga year.
So you're going to get out of solar mass and you're going to get a lot of solar mass.
So you could do it. Yeah, maybe.
Well, it's not an easy thing to do, because you have to do it. It's a delicate balance, because you have to do it at that point in the evolution where. You know, R dot over R is large enough that you're going to get steady equilibrium.
But we have.
It can't be so large that the star is just about to give up the ghost.
We have these wide X-ray binaries that must have done something like that. Wide binary radio pulsar, actually, systems, which must have done something like that.
Even if you're transferring mass at 10 to the minus 9 solar mass G, you still need the stable burning, which I guess is very difficult.
That's what Rosen just said. You have to fill the Roche-Loeb at a later time, such that the R dot's higher. So
but if you have 10 to the minus 8, can you then have stable burning? I think Starfield says yes, but Nomoto says no. What?
Everybody else says no.
This is why I've raised the issue with Lars and other people. You know, how much, and with Margarita, how much do you retain in the current nova phase? So, I mean, I think with some of these, there's a distinction between the recurrent novae and steady nuclear burning. And in fact, for the symbiotics that we see recurrent novae, right? So the issue is, when you have a recurrent nova, you're allowing M dot to be a little bit smaller, so that if you're not in the steady burning regime, if you can hang on to that mass, then you can grow.
Sure.
If it turns out that you have significant mass ejection in the recurrent nova phase, you won't. So, you know, whether or not that channel, which I think has been neglected here, is important, really comes down to some of the nuclear physics that I know people will talk about later on.
But cannot we make this afternoon some back of the envelope calculation on this and the other?
Yeah, or tomorrow over pancakes. Yeah,
oh, tomorrow over pancakes. Yeah. All the napkins.
I have theory.
It must be possible. It must be possible to do it.
I've looked at this in the past, and that's why I think it works. And in this time delay calculation I presented a month or so ago, that was included. Don't see why it's not been included in these things, except for the fact that there is a potential issue of fine tuning, right?
Yeah.
Is exactly what I was saying. Fill at the right time, and you have to be able to retain.
Well, but I think you can provide the target, right? You can say this is what you need to have if you want to have this work. Yes. And the common envelope people will make it work.
The point is, if you need to fine tune,
to do the basic physics, you can do right, and then that provides the right.
We can also look at the binary radio pulsars, the millisecond ones in the wide binaries. You see them in globular clusters. You see them in an old population. And those ones, I think that was a massive oxygen near magnesium white dwarf driven over the Chandra limit. I think that's the best scenario for those guys, I think. Because you find young pulsars in globular clusters. The only way to make a young pulsar in globular cluster is driving a white dwarf over there.
But then it doesn't explode, because you're left with a neutron star.
Yeah, you are left with a neutron star, but by analogy, you will also have carbon-oxygen white dwarfs with such companions, and they may blow up as a type 1A supernova in an old population.
So you're saying we should see the supernova 1A's in globular clusters as well?
I would think so,
That's the talk next week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but I think you would have to monitor quite a number of globular clusters to see one. I mean, in MAT.
So you don't do that way. That's not how you do it.
What?
That's not how you do it.
Okay.
You convince the observers to look 2 years later after supernovae and discover that there was a
globular cluster.
Which is unfortunately not happening.
Yeah.
Now, I just wanted to say, so I think this is one scenario which certainly I've included piece of work, but there's also the shorter time one, which we're still assessing how important it is, but this is the case where you start out with a very wide binary and two massive stars, and one of them becomes a white dwarf, a pretty massive white dwarf, because nothing has happened to interrupt its evolution. The other one evolves, and as it is at the point in its evolution where it's emitting a very large wind, that this guy just needs to capture a few percent of it to go over the Chandrasekhar mass and either become an accretion-induced collapse or a type 1A supernova, depending on exactly what it was. Now, Eric and I are working on this model, and we're trying to assess exactly how important it is. But it's very prompt because these are it has also a time delay component because it really depends on how massive the secondary is. But it has a prompt component, and if things that become white dwarfs tend to evolve by about 10 to the 8 years.
But are they not included in these? Basically, they should be, I would think.
They should be included in that, and I've discussed that with Lev a little bit, and it's sort of an implicit part of one of the calculations that he's done with Phillips' group. So that's where the two groups come together now.
Okay.
Lev and Phillips' group have worked together. But there is the issue of, if you take a look at the integrated type 1A rate, I think it comes out to be a fairly small component of the integrated rate. Mm-hmm. But because it's prompt, it's fast. So there are times after the star formation epoch where it's contributing at a high rate, even though if you average over the entire lifetime of activity from that first star formation, it's only a small part of it.
But wouldn't those have hydrogen again in the atmosphere?
Well, that's a big problem, yes, for all of them. The only thing, I don't understand that the calculations well enough to know if it's genuinely ruled out by lack of hydrogen. The only thing, though, that both this prompt component and the other delayed component have in common that might save them is that they're both very wide binaries. And so, you know, you have, it's not protected because it's going to be top the envelope and you might think it's going to lose it right away.
On the other hand, that's also a problem because it has to catch. The massive wide warp that you first make has to catch a few percent of the wind of the other. So if you make it wider, that fraction goes down and down. So, I mean, that's also an argument against this channel.
You're becoming an expert at these kinds of calculations. What happens with every single scenario? There's always this fine-tuning issue. And even for this one over here, that it shows us, why does Jochelson disagree with Forster? And well, gosh, it's very hard to get a close binary superstar source where M dot is high enough to bring you in the right range, and still it's stable. And so the assumptions that you make there, based on what you think is the best input physics, but you and I can disagree, and you know, honestly disagree about it, can give you results that differ by a factor of a few. So it's very confusing.
So when I first came here, I thought the double degenerate model was dead because it didn't match the observations very well. But here it looks like it's the best way of making a prompt component.
Yeah.
Is that a good reading of what's going on?
Yeah, well, we may not like it.
I mean, I may not like it, but could be right. Yes. Could very well be right. I came here also with the idea the super soft must be the guy to do it. But
I mean, can't say it that. 50 million years, or can it be 10 to the 8 years?
I'm trying to be involved in theoretical disputes because this is not my job. However, I don't see hydrogen in the spectra.
Right.
I remember a paper by Branch and the student Boffi. They try to put an upper limit on the M dot of the red giant companion in case of a symbiotic scenario, and that upper limit was quite strict. Nino Panagia did the same recently on observation, radio observation. One is supernova, and they don't find any kind of.
There is no one that has radio.
No one. In a few years, 10 years ago, with Mario Livia, we computed the rate of recurrent novae in M31, and we compared with the rate of 1A, and that was two order magnitude lower.
You compared one thing, you said the recurrent.
Well, can the recurrent novae be the type of
the recurrent novae at the time?
Okay.
And so all of this, in my opinion, argued against the idea of a single degenerate, at least for this prompt component or whatever.
But still, even though it is small, there is a peak here, which gives them a few billion years.
There is a theoretical peak, yes.
Yeah. yeah. But you can't ignore that.
Not completely yet here. Right.
And if these guys are right, the peak is even higher.
And then it should start to show up at one point. I mean, if you have enough supernovae, then a few percent of those, or the fraction that is made up by this peak, should show through.
Yeah, so I think
I'm sure an engine does both.
Well,
the big question is what is the bulk of them?
Right.
My sense is we see three types of supernovae. So there are three types of type 1A that are known today. Peter can correct me. There's the branch normal, of which there's many.
Yeah.
There's the 91 BGs, which are seem to be greatest in class, and there's the O2CX05HK type. So by counting, I see three types of type 1As today. And the ratio, the relative rates of those are still unknown. I think 91 BGs, Sloan's going to hopefully give us a number. But it might be, playing with PGs, it might be 20 to 50%. Well, 20%, I would say, is probably just not pulled out yet. The O2CXs appear to be maybe 1 in 100, 1 in 50, something like
and
that.
And what is their special characteristic?
They don't follow the Phillips relation.
It's the one that Sirov talked about.
That's the one that Sirov talked about. Okay.
They don't seem to have undergone a detonation.
Well, I was first saying what do the observers say, not the theorists, right? Observers say they don't follow the Phillips relation, and at late times their nebular spectrum is still optically thick.
They're slow, isn't it?
And they're very slow people. So there's three types of type 1A supernovae. So that's good because we've got six areas.
Wait a second. I mean, Sirov specifically said, if I remember correctly, and I may not because I'm always getting these numbers mixed up, didn't he say that he thought that 91 BG is okay, that, you know, it's on the Phillips relation?
It is on the Phillips relation. Yeah.
He said, you know, basically, his argument was that the other one he was talking about, which if you remember,
that's
really weird, but
well,
he was willing to accommodate.
Okay, but I think the 91 BG likes are, you know, they have a nickel mass of 0.05. Okay, they only are really seen in old populations. They have, the ejected mass might be less than 1.3. The case for the ejected mass being near Shannon's star is not as good as the others. And I think the spectra stuff that was done is now understood more as just temperature issues rather than something having to do with abundances. But you know they look yes, and you can put them on these, you know, Peter did this.
There could be a gap. I mean, there's a few ones that fall in between the branch normal and the classical ones. But it could be, you could still argue for two populations.
We are finding
mechanisms and some that kind of fall in.
Actually, we are finding some that are filling this gap now.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay. And are they indeed only in old populations, these types of underluminous?
Certainly in low star formation rate galaxies is the main characteristic, and you can take that to mean old, and from what little we've done with actually looking at the population, it appears that yes, they are in the oldest population.
And not seen in a spiral, but not in the disk.
Oh, so they are in a spiral.
Of course, but they're not in the disk. They're in the halo. Again, I'm looking at Peter's. I'm not keeping score, but last time
they have been seen in disk galaxies, but it's not clear that they're part of the disk population. Mm-hmm. Legalistic.
What percentage of all supernovae aren't that
counted? 20%. Mm-hmm. And the CXs is only 1%, you said?
I don't think we have a number for that.
Hmm. I think Sirov had maybe five or six in his sample, and out of 150 supernovae, 100 supernovae.
Who paper Matheson?
No, it was the paper by Bedon Lee. They say 70% branch normal, about 40% BG, and rest 91D of this overbride. That was
the overbride. It's not clear to me the overbrights are.
I mean, there is one really overbright one in the SNLS, but that.
Yeah. Is 91T on the Phillips relation?
Yes.
But I don't have to say much more. I see them.
This is a great way to get
started. Now I need to put your thing on
my screen. I got it up here.
What?
You sent it to me.
Oh, okay.
I have it here. If you're having a problem.
Yeah, I don't know
if
it's. If you can.
It's not working.
Yeah, but where is it? How do I open it?
Okay, I have a feeling.
Let's see. Where do you see it?
There's a faster solution.
Oh, I have a removable disk here. Let's see. Is this thing with the
us? Should we vote on favorite channels?
I don't like to vote.
PBS.
It's not a democracy.
Whatever happens will be. Well, I guess, if we vote on enough things, will be right. Sometimes it will be wrong. But do you want this whole workshop to go down?
I'm not going to allow a vote. The reason I say is I never forget that Bodin Kuczynski gave a beautiful talk about Montgomery versus cosmological in 1986 at a meeting, and he was laughed out of the room.
Oh, was he really?
Yes.
Who was this?
Bodin in 1986. And it was a reminder of how wrong.
Sure. Well, you only do voting when you can't explain it.
Well, this is just, unfortunately, this is not at all settled. I mean, they're showing results from the Anglican codex, which are the only ones in my knowledge that have been able, with some tricks, as everybody is still coached, to handle multiple flashes in multiple nova outputs, and then in principle they can produce an asymptote. When they predict there is some kind of asymptotic behavior, well, you can give a link to parameters or have some control. But at least they compute so many models that perhaps you can extract some conclusion from that. So for instance, here they show the accreted mass versus the attrition rate. That's it. Accreted mass versus mass of the radar. And the accretion rate is, so these models have different initial luminosities, different accretion rates. So they are not these stabilized models, you could say. It's another view. We take all the possibilities and then you see what happens. So they have this range. Okay, this would be the big relation from McDonald or others, where you consider that it's a pressure at the base of the envelope. And depending on the mass of the white gap, you have an accreted mass. So you can have points. A lot of French. Well, this is for the fifth temperature, but also the what they can compute finally is the ejected version of the accreted mass and corresponding to the previous model they have this way. So what do they obtain? That if you have you have small accretion rates for all principal possible masses and initial luminosities, the mass of the white dwarf will decrease. It will be the violent explosions, where in principle you lose more mass than you think. And on the contrary, if you have large accretion rates, also giving in principle this nova explosion, but here it's not so clear if you have a nova explosion or steady burning, but they can really make the mass of the white dwarf increase because this will be the slide. So, well, of course, you can discuss a lot. We can discuss a lot about that, but in principle, it can give us some hints of something that is more or less logical. And it's for large accretion rates and some initial conditions, we can get that. But this is a kind of statistical result. Of course, one should go through particular cases. Now, with Zerbi, we are computing some models for RSO50, obviously, without initial mixing. And in fact, what we are obtaining, what we are just doing that now, is that less, you take less mass than what we accrete. So in these cases, we are taking 10 to the minus 7 to our mass. It's not exactly what we expect as a robot, but in this recurrent NOVI, there are not so much enhancements in the method. So perhaps we are on the right way to obtain that. This is more or less predictable. It doesn't solve the problem because one has to see how many of these exist and all of other aspects. But in principle, if you have a system like this regular NOVI where you have a large accretion rate and a large initial mass, say 1.38 solar masses, for instance, you can have that. And the, well, that we are not engineer, which is probably what we want to do for each other in the
table. What parameter causes that range?
Well, this is initial luminosity. I don't remember what 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3 solar luminosity, something like that. They take perhaps also a bit larger in some cases. Here, initial mass. So each symbol corresponds to a case that have black chain with the check in the tape. The problem here is that, well, this kind of the way to follow different flashes has its problems, of course, because how do you lose mass between one and another? Well, the conservation of energy, we have been discussing some of these topics, it's not completely clear, but I think we can something is true from that.
That seems like, you know, in order to help really understand the progenitor problem, if the parameters can be pushed a little bit, so, you know, 10 to the minus 7 is interesting, but it's sometimes hard to get that accretion rate in some of the binaries that we think might be progenitors. So if that rate can, if the explorations can take it down to the range of a few times 10 to the minus 8,
so we
can fill in that area. And also, of course, the initial mass of the white dwarf is very important, because I think, you know, all things agree that if you start out very, very close to the Chandrasekhar mass, we don't know enough to say that you couldn't get there. You know,
yes,
seems
well,
likely you might
yes,
do it.
I agree completely.
But what about when you start out at 0.9 solar masses or 1 solar mass, and you really have significant
depletion? Which end is the high mass, the low mass on the spread?
In the 0.6,
that's the wrong direction.
Ah, okay.
The vertical spread.
Oh, it's clear.
Well, if you have a small mass and big range, this is where we're also discussing a bit and then the other data. There are models by the Italian group with the planning code, so they have Santi, Cassisi, and Tornande, and even 98, where they have, if it's higher than a creature, is what they are assuming. You have weak flashes in this zone, hydrogen flashes. And they have followed that with a hydrostatic code in this case, because in principle these are something else. And what they get, and we also got that, and other groups have got that, with more simple models, one-zone models, two-zone models, analytical models. What you get is that you accumulate finally helium, because since these weak flashes do not detect mass, and you accumulate it more or less at the same rate as a creature. So finally, it comes to a situation which is more or less equivalent to the direct accretion of helium. But the heating provoked by these hydrogen flashes changes the conditions, and they have studied that. And it's interesting because the hydrogen flashes heat the helium that is being formed. So the final explosion of emission of helium with this rate is not as explosive as it would be if it's say a catastrophe of helium. And perhaps instead of being this typical detonation of the liquid.
Well, then it looks like an AGB star, right? So if you're having hydrogen shell burn and you're building up a helium shell underneath it, then you're right, it's much hotter. In which case the mass of the helium shell is much smaller, and it looks like an AGB helium flash.
Excuse me,
it looks like a helium flash on the asymptotic giant branch. Mm-hmm. Right, because an asymptotic giant branch is stable burning of hydrogen. And so the M dot is stable burning M dot, because that's what the envelope provides you. So we know what the thermal conditions are. But the helium shell is just like that on the asymptotic giant branch.
Well, it's a bit different probably because the density and the asymptotic giant density is high. Well, it could be similar, but. Anyway, in these papers, they took what they have to say, that they started with very low masses. They don't have the same computation for large matter, but they have 0.5 and 0.8 probably because they have, surely, because they have problems of computation to follow that. And they, what they wanted to say. So, well, I mean that, yes, this case is intense, but one should not forget about what will happen after we leave the field. Because if you reach this dangerous zone, which is interesting as well, of course. But it's another. So, I mean that perhaps then this will prevent the increase of mass because you finally eject the helium. It will depend a lot. And this has been studied by Todd Sorkin in a range of parameters. It's very broad and I feel possibilities.
Is there,
this will be the problem, I think, in this range.
Is there a dredge-up prescription in these models?
Dredge-up? No. Ah, well, these models, they don't mix.
Okay.
Well, they include thermal diffusion,
right,
which in some way mixes. But this is only effective when the time scale is large enough, so for the low rotation rate, not it doesn't play my problem, which is one of the problems. This mechanism is direct, which is you don't introduce any parameterization, would be very nice, but it does not very not effective enough for large rotation rates. You don't have time. But for the lower rotation rates, yes, it's important.
But presumably, if there was dredge up in these bursts, then the ejected mass would increase?
Yes, it would change. Sure. This is, we could say, the other side. It's without any mixing except the natural.
Well, it would be interesting to just take some very crude dredge-up mechanism and just parameterize it and just see how much that adds to the spread of these. I don't know if it would be more important than mass or core temperature or not.
But now we are trying to do that in a paper as we do this mixing in this more natural way instead of parameterizing just from the beginning to wait until convection is active and then do this kind of undershooting, which has been claimed since many years ago, like 20 years. But it was in 1996 or something like that. But well, introduce it in some natural way. You change the parameter. You add a new parameter, which is this time scale of mixing associated with the time scale of convection. Of course, there is always this underlying problem of mixing. Well, so this was one thing to show. And finally, but I wanted to comment again that, of course, theory is well known. To remind, this is from 98, and years ago, there's stuff here to run well to show. You can say that these are not all knowledge, but this is
I would love to see an update.
Interesting knowledge.
Unfortunately, we must know more than this by now.
We really have these very large enhancements in neon and generally non metals, so it's clear that something is going on here, and there should be some mixing. And then, with what we need, I presented that already a few years ago when we organized a meeting here in Warsaw. So, just to remind what has been said already, that we know that massive white dwarfs are not carbon. So, it's important for Novi, but in general, for the topic here. With what we are mixing, or what is under, what's the composition of the underlying white dwarfs? Well, we know that massive white dwarfs, and we'll see what means massive, are not carbon oxygen, but oxygen neon. What's this frontier? Apparently, this frontier is around this value. We will show you now, and I found a paper yesterday that is interesting, if you can comment now about that. And also, it's important that many computations of this type, which are very time-consuming, complicated, have started with single evolutions, because we should handle with these flashes and these staging effects and all these things. Doing carbon burning to see what's the final result. But of course, we are interested in binary systems. Many of these white dwarfs are in binary systems, the case that interests us for Novi supernovae. So there have been already attempts to do that in binary systems. They change, well, of course it will depend on which kind of evolution they take for the binary and which kind of initial condition. But they obtain a result that is logical, that in fact it's harder to get these items. Because you need with a larger initial mass, you get a lower course, so finally, if one takes that with puts the IMF, you need a delivery system. Well, just was the point that.
Could you say that again? I'm not sure that I understood the point. Would you just mind repeating it again?
This last point. Uh-huh. Yes, since you take into account the effect of binarity, you will lose more mass, and for a same progenitor mass, you will get a lower mass white dwarf. So if you make up the you count the number of systems you have, you have less. Then you know, we have well. So this is amazing. You can change a little number, but when I was studying many years ago, this I remember that long canal. He said this intermediate massage is 8 minus, how do you say, well, plus minus 2, but I mean that the range could be 2 solar masses or 0, no? It's not established. But more or less, in the range where you have, so for masses less than 8 or 10 solar masses, you begin with carbon oxygen burning, and in this same range here, a bit larger perhaps, you can you have carbon burning off-center and you end with oxygen. This really is not, that's not well known, no, it's better known, but I think that it's not still completely settled. So with a single evolution, more or less, they get that. For a 10 solar mass star, they obtain this 1.2 solar mass oxygen input. So this would mean that massive star, way down less massive than 1.2 are carbon oxygen ones. Yes.
Before you go, I'm a bit surprised about the limits here. If I remember, Stephen Smart is doing this project to find supernovae, corpolite supernovae before they go off, so that we know what the progenitors are. And if I remember his results correctly, he actually finds that most of the supernovae that he sees going off have progenitors that he at least estimates to be in the 10 solar mass region. But these are going off a supernovae.
Yes.
So is it also possible for a 10 solar mass star to make a supernova?
So you see, it's this problem that I have this limit.
But can you distinguish between 10 and 11?
Well, he claims you can.
When?
I don't.
You see, you have the answer. He claims.
Because I think in recent years people have been fixing now this upper limit at 11. Mm-hmm. So and then after that you get iron core collapses. And the idea which Philip Podzidlowski and some people put forward is that up to 11 single stars make white dwarfs. So on the asymptotic giant branch, because you have this dredge up, you erode away the helium layer around this oxygen near magnesium core, and it cannot grow any further. So up to 11 solar masses, all the stars, the single ones, would leave white dwarfs, because on the asymptotic giant branch they have this dredge up. And then they go immediately, the single ones go immediately to iron core collapses. So you never have the electron capture collapse. But you can have it in a binary, because there you remove the envelope before it goes to the asymptotic giant branch. You have the helium, you keep it, and the helium core can make the oxygen and magnesium core grow. So the electron capture supernovae would only happen in binaries, and not in single stars. That is what Philip's recent ideas on this number of colors.
I wanted to say that these ranges can become zero.
And yeah, but people have said 11 seems now to be more or less the Munich group, the Max Planck.
But it's observational paper that was presented at the conference by Curtis Williams. And in that one, I've included some in my code, I think for something like an 8.4 solar mass white dwarf, you develop a 1.4 solar mass, for an 8.4 solar mass star, you develop a 1.4 solar mass white dwarf.
The data only go up to 6 solar masses.
That is from clusters.
From clusters. So 6 is 1. That's a point something.
Yeah, but if you believe his relationship, he gives a linear relationship. Yeah. It's a constant plus something times the mass. That would tell you that it's about a smaller mass, if you want 8.4 solar masses or so, that leads to...
That's right, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so I don't know, it may or may not continue. Yeah. It may change dramatically, but it would have to change dramatically over a relatively small mass range.
But I found this argument by Philip quite convincing, you know, because on the asymptotic giant branch you have this dredge up, and so this prevents the degenerate core to grow further. And so his idea is that up to 11 single stars, but maybe most stars are in binary, so we still would have most one.
Right, so the challenge I put to that, to Philip, is that if that's true, then you should find the diversity of initial final mass relations in the white dwarf sequence.
Yes.
And that's the only proof you can have.
But so clusters with those turn-off masses, like 11 or so, are extremely
high. No, but the theory applies down to lower masses. There's nothing special about, what they say, there's nothing special that wouldn't happen at when the turn-off mass is 3 or 4 solar masses, for those white dwarfs and binaries.
Okay.
So basically, if they're right, there should be diversity.
There should be.
In the initial final mass relation, which so far isn't the case.
Is that not the case?
That's not
the case. I mean, can
so you... I think they're ruled out by what's known in clusters. That's what I told him. But there's a test.
The white dwarfs in binaries in clusters, they're hidden behind the other star.
I'm saying that if you believe the white dwarf fraction that should be in binaries, then there should be a diversity. You can't tell if it's in a binary, which means there'd be a scatter in the initial final mass relation.
Yeah, but can you in a cluster see a white dwarf which is in a binary?
No. You can see a white dwarf.
Yeah, you only see the remnants of the singles.
Yes.
And you don't see any of the binaries.
Well, people working on that.
But that's the big problem. In the higher views, I see there's only 10 or 12 white dwarfs. And if you really extrapolate the initial mass function from what you see, the number of main sequence stars, you must have 50 white dwarfs. And people find only 12. And I think all the other guys are hidden in binaries. You don't see them.
But we'll know it pretty soon. I mean, people are looking for those, I think.
Can you see that?
Are you sure? What hides them when they're about here?
The luminosity of the companion.
The luminosity of
the companion. The shown by the companion.
The number is far too little in the high edition, no? And I presume in other clusters, in the pre edition, there's only one. And if you extrapolate, there must be several. And I think all these guys are hidden by another.
I agree with you, Ed, but I think we can uncover that population.
But look at Dave Latham's work, right? And he's looking at all these clusters, and it's true, you don't actually see the white dwarf, except in some cases.
If it's really white,
you do. But what he does have is he has his orbital data on the bright stars, so you can see if they have a companion.
Yeah.
So there is some data, although it's only the brightest of the white dwarfs that you eventually say, aha, that definitely is a white dwarf. But when you have a very dim companion that's 0.8 solar masses or 0.6 solar masses.
Well, then it becomes easy because then you can see the white dwarf for much longer because it's not outshone by the companion.
In the
FG type stars, the normal solar type stars, where you have the big problem. The luminosity of the companion is so much higher than the luminosity of the white dwarf that you don't see it.
In the high, these low on the main sequence, you have two M dwarfs, which is a white dwarf, which go in a very narrow orbit, and then you have this one system, which is the K dwarf,
the famous one.
But those you see again because they're so close.
Yeah.
But then you have the white binaries, and I'm not so sure that it's easy to find them. But you guys are observers, must work on that.
We are at.
Well, just to finish that, this is what function that we ever obtained the model. So this is a function of the mass in the 0H main sequence. They follow this BD, the Galois-Thomas, so this evolution cycle. So this is the mass of the core, and this is the point where carbon emission occurs. If it occurs in the center, then it does not become this super HV star. It's not an oxygen neon. Without this, we go to the supernova, say. But if you really have this situation here, you see, where we ignite off center, then they follow that. Of course, there are many complications, and what they can say that the outcome then is oxygen and neon. We say oxygen and neon because what is this? You know, what it is called single binding, you have this capabilities composition which is made of the neon. This is fraction by mass. This is perhaps the most illustrative to see the difference, say, from single evolution, single star evolution of binary, you see, that what we were saying before. So this is the final oxygen-neon core. Also, there is this buffer, what you can call a buffer of carbon-oxygen, which is not burned, which is on top of the core. So what we can consider the global mass is the addition of both. And you see, for instance, for a 10 solar mass star with the GOH in sequence, they obtain, instead of the 1.2, you see the binary evolution, with 1.1. Well, this was just to, well, this has some, it was the reason of that paper, some effect, but not so much. And this is what is affecting this fraction of novae occurring in oxygen neon. Like that, we get more or less the same results as maybe a year and 2 years ago. But a part of this, it was the reason to do that paper. The important thing here is that, which is more or less known, but it is applied exactly to this scenario of massive white dwarf and to the oxygen, what this was then.
So, yeah, I just want to be sure I'm understanding this issue of the fraction. So the neon-rich novae, I still thought there were two. There was a paper by Turin, and they were making a point about the neon richness, because carbon-oxygen has neon-22. And so if you dredge up carbon-oxygen and that neon-22 is mixed in, it looks neon-rich relative to solar.
Yes, I guess this paper was, but well, we would say that just the neon in this case, but not other enrichments.
Right, so if you go back to your Garrett's plot, we go back for a minute, my memory was there were only a few where you couldn't explain it as just neon 22. So the neon, that those ones that in the blue boxes you've got, I think those...
You see, well, they have, not all, but they have also enrichments in, well, this is...
I'm looking at your neon, the second to last column, neon over neon solar.
Yes.
Right, so I thought these numbers like 5 and 10, that could just be neon 22 and carbon oxygen.
But I think this, I shouldn't don't remember if I have the numbers, but this, just this neon 22, you cannot have so large and cosmic, it's very well. There were these intermediate, no? From some cases where there is some neon, but not much, perhaps you can...
Right.
Explain, but for the real neon novae.
So what I'm asking is, when somebody says it's a neon novae.
Well, is it?
When someone says it was a neon novae.
It's not so well defined. I agree with you that in some cases neon.
10 or 100, yeah.
But in principle, neon novae has not just the neon, but also some other characteristics that make you concerning the abundances and about others. That make you think that really it should be in an oxygen.
Okay, so
perhaps there is some intermediate case that we can explain.
So Olivier Turin, I thought, said that the number was not 1/3 on oxygen neon white dwarfs, because it was only those where neon was enhanced by a factor of 100 that clearly told you were on an oxygen neon white dwarf. So the number was much smaller.
You're right. The number is much smaller, but since they go to the outburst more frequently, when you consider the number of the nova frequency, you are biased.
Got it.
Did you get it?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
For sure, the number has to be smaller than 30%.
No, we are talking about novae, not about the
is a fraction of outburst of this.
But this is taken into account as well, Livio, Bias, and Livio. Of course,
yeah, so
if you take this into account, if not, you...
The simple point is to look at the neon column, right? 2% is the neon abundance at a carbon-oxygen. Okay, so if it's above 0.02, if that neon column is above 0.02, then it probably was on an oxygen neon white dwarf. And there's very few there that are above
0.2. I don't remember the number, but well, Turin, we just we work.
That was
Turin, I think we agree that to the numbers. So for the, in fact, it could reach 50%. So sure. 30%, I think, is not so bad for the real oxygen meal. But of course, there is some zone where there is some confusion, perhaps. But it's always taken into account that when you compute this, of course, you are not just counting. You compute the rate of Novi.
50% of Novi coming from oxygen, neon, magnesium, white dwarf is a very, is an incredible number.
Is
I never seen that number.
So well, I can show you in the city paper.
Yes.
Especially in this one.
No, but is that I wrote a paper with Mario on this, and the point was that we observe 30% of Novi. Do we believe you come from a white dwarf, oxygen named magnesium white dwarf? But this is the number of outbursts.
Yes, we are saying this
should have a recognized time of the order of 3 to 4 years.
No, we are saying
it is about one to order of magnitude shorter than the recognized time of carbon, oxygen, small mass white dwarf.
I'm not saying that one third of the weight out of oxygen here, of course, will be completely crazy. In binary, sweet room. But we worked in that paper, but this is not the main point here. But it was if this change in initial final mass relation affects a bit and doesn't affect much. So,
it's actually quite interesting. What you're saying is in binaries, the ones that might have become neon oxygen are more likely to become, more likely to become carbon oxygen, and therefore you're saving some more that could possibly become type 1A supernova.
The problem will be that really if we look back, well, this plot of Sharon Pialnik and the general calculations really. It's difficult to increase the mass unless at the biggest under second mass you don't have a massive one. So if, are you able to really increase from 1.1 to 1.4? So these are, I cannot avoid that problem.
We discussed this earlier. Is 1.1 secure? I mean, many other people are
saying. Well, this paper.
We need to do seismology. The short answer is, what has to happen, you have to do seismology.
Right.
White dwarf seismology of a 1.3 solar mass white dwarf. From that,
where?
Whether it's carbon, oxygen, or oxygen neon. Actually, it's not been done.
Right.
And there's out there, which you can do it.
You shouldn't be doing it on one of them, but on quite a few of them, because then
I can start with one.
Of course.
I would encourage you observers to get, there's a lot of these in Sloan. There's a lot of these objects in Sloan, which are massive, in the Zeta-Setting stability strip, which are 21st magnitude objects. And you need to do pulsation studies on those, you need 4 meter telescope. So I
agree to spread around the world.
I check it only around the world in the network.
Not to get started. So that should be done. That's an easy project.
Do you want that straight away, or do you want to take a break?
It's very late, so I guess the question is how, if we take a break, then we're committing to a longer session. Each of you guys would want to go. So should we take a break?
I think people will probably want to take a break or not.
Everybody has to go
before they change their mind. Do you want to close the?
Yeah. Do it quickly. There we go.
That's fine. He knows what I want to say. That's okay. Right. So I want to return to this thing on supernova researches and all the surveys that are coming up and are ongoing.
And the session that we had 3 weeks ago on Friday, where we went through all the surveys, and which was quite enlightening for me, actually.
Frightening or enlightening?
Both. So I want to take that theme that Bob presented on that same day as life is a bottom feeder. What can we get on galactic science from all these extragalactic surveys? And I think that one thing that has also become clear to me is that the question and use of supernovae 1As for cosmological purposes and understanding supernovae 1A all will hinge on an understanding of them at low redshifts and also the progenitors in the galaxy as well, as we have seen already in the discussion today. So I wanted to go through a couple of things, and basically to go over again what is needed from these surveys to actually make them useful for galactic science, so that we can basically get something out of that as well, and what is interesting there. So I thought I would do this in three bunches, just to see what can we do on existing surveys. What would be needed for new surveys that are going to start pretty soon, big things, and some conclusions that we can draw from all this. And of course, I purposely did not make a PowerPoint presentation or whatever, because it's hard to add things in real life, so that's why I do this the old-fashioned way, because we can add things there. So for existing surveys, and what will be needed to get galactic, science. No, that's not the way to write science. Science out of extragalactic surveys. So I actually thought of calling this intergalactic surveys. I guess galactic surface is just fine. So if we look, for instance, at a survey like the SDSS, which is of course a great survey, then one conclusion is that all of these extragalactic surveys are at high galactic latitude. Yeah? So the consequence of that is that you're fairly quickly volume limited and not magnitude limited anymore. So, for instance, in the SDSS, if we take the limit of SDSS, say it's 20 per magnitude, if you have an absolute magnitude smaller than about 11, you are already volume limited. Unless you're looking at the halo population, but you go out for kiloparsec or something like that, so you're done with the galactic volume if you are at high galactic latitude. So, this is something for the new surveys. If you want to also please the galactic people, so to say, the question is, can you point at lower galactic latitude? There is always a preference to go to the galactic pole, basically. But I think that extinction-wise, you don't have to be at the pole. I mean, you can go down quite a bit before you really start to run into extinction problems if you want to go extragalactic. And I think that we figured out for the Palomar Transient factory that if you were to be able to point at the B between say 10 to 20 degrees, then you solve quite a bit of galactic volume, about a kiloparsec. You go through the galactic plane or the galaxy itself before you exit the galaxy. So that would be, I think, sort of an ideal latitude to go through, to go at. So one of the conclusions might be, or the question for new surveys, is how low can you go?
What's the negative for them?
Contamination.
Sorry?
The amount of contamination is growing.
Yeah, the amount of galactic stars is growing, the amount of extinction is growing. So this limits the magnitude that you will effectively reach in your extragalactic survey.
But there's no reason for near Earth objects, right? Some of the new surveys are motivated in part by looking for near Earth objects.
Right, right.
And for those, you don't want to limit yourself to things outside the galactic plane, right?
Well, you want to look at the ecliptic. Or, well, if it's really near Earth, I guess it's a lovely place. Yeah.
So I think that motivates that when you say how low can you go, I think they have to go low.
Right. Well, that's good.
Yeah, well, so Bansar's 3-pi survey will be okay for you.
Yes. Yes.
3-pi is better
than any 2-pi or whatever. I mean, anything that is more than, say, 10,000, that has to include some low galactic latitude stuff as well. So one other thing on the existing surveys that I think we noticed very much, is that there's a lot of time being dedicated, I could say wasted, on finding the same thing. Because everybody wants to get W down to 5%, and not all of the quality of all these surveys will not be the same. And let's be honest here, some of them will be better, some of them will be worse. So we may as well use the other ones as well.
Well, the question is, can we predict in advance which ones will be better?
I think we can, but I won't do that here. you can try that, Lars. You can. So I think one of the themes would be not only to collect your waste.
But also take out the trash.
Oh yeah. So I think that's another conclusion that we should write down, is take out the trash. So that other people can go through it.
And finding this HTTPN star in a KDTP
talk was quite shocking to me. if this is just a random example, then we actually are in for some few more systems, I think. Another thing for also, so that of course this applies also to the new surveys. Take out the trash. Something that also applies to the new surveys, I think. And there we run into the danger, and Bob sent around this thing on the Nature by Simon White, that we're all looking at one thing to get one thing from all our surveys. And that is a bit of a risk if we do that, and sometimes you have to do that because, for instance, telemetry doesn't allow you to download all the stuff that you collect. But I think, at least for ground-based, we should try to save the pixels. That is, don't just go through all your data and just pick out whatever you want and throw away the rest, but try to save it. And I know this is a data storage issue, but we also know that data storage, I mean, it's increasing so quickly that unless you're really doing the whole sky every night, you should be able to store it in some way. So don't. I mean, for the people doing the new survey or designing new surveys, don't be too narrow-minded in what you want to reach, but try also, without compromising your own goals, but try to save, because people may actually like that.
So basically, you say, don't follow the particle physics.
Yes.
Away.
I think that was. I think that's Simon White's point, is that indeed the fixation there is on one thing to get that really determined. I think that we run into the same risk if we say, okay, we all want to get W down to some certain percentage, that we run the risk to actually close our mind on everything else that might be out there. So we, as Bob said yesterday, we have to keep our mind open and our eyes as well.
I don't think it's a problem of saving the pixels. I think it's a problem of access to the pixels once they're saved and having, you know, some way of, you know, writing software that would allow you to get all the pixels is an expensive
thing. Yeah. But there, I certainly hope that all this effort that has been put into virtual observatories the world over, actually will go in not making all kinds of nice Java applets that pop up all over your screen, but actually to go into taking out the useful data there. So Something also for new surveys is colors. I think that most surveys that are being designed for supernovae and stuff like that do take colors into account. At the same time, get color information while you're at it.
It's important for the supernovae.
It's important for the supernovae, but it's not only important for the supernovae, it's important for everything. And I think that that transient that we saw yesterday that you presented, where the Japanese astronomer had this precursor for the supernova, and you looked it up and there were 4 points and there was no color information. This is something that happened with gamma ray bursts, for instance, in the afterglows in the early days as well, that we had this beautiful light curve but in one color. And colors are extremely important. So this is not only for the big surveys, but also for amateur astronomers out there somewhere, who are doing this. I know it's difficult, and there's various ways you can do this. Of course, getting colors, you can take the expensive approach, which is the LBT approach, by just building two mirrors and have a blue and a red
really
camera.
There are other reasons why they're.
I know. But I think it's a nice extreme example. For instance, I think the Las Cumbres observatory is great, but we need to push them not to adopt the same LBT approach, just having two telescopes look at the same thing, because the dichroic in 2CZ really is cheaper than building a second telescope.
Really, really, it's interference and it'll improve the resolution. Someday.
No, I understand why it is. I mean, that's not the problem. Okay. Another thing, especially for the transient surveys, and this is a point that Lars and me and Danny and all a bunch of people discussed yesterday over lunch, is how often do we need to sample to get, for instance, a variable object? It might be a supernova, it might be a dwarf nova, an AMGVN star, whatever. And then the question was, and I'm sure that you're going to come back to this.
I've arrived at quote unquote.
Quite, excellent. But if I may give away the punchline already, the observer's view of Lars.
I'll know the answer.
The observer's view of what Lars is going to say is that if you want to detect things efficiently, you have to sample on basically the e-folding time of your event. So if you're looking at a supernova which changes on time scale 15 days, you have to do the sample once every 15 days, and that's the most efficient way of finding these things. There's a but there. If you want to do something with that data, not just discover it, but get some physical information from that as well, of course you will need follow-up. And the follow-up could be, for instance, the Las Cumbres Observatory, but in general, I see a problem coming for all the transient surveys is that we are going to be follow-up limited, right? Whether it be photometric or spectroscopy. So I think it's very important to get as much out of the transient survey as you can. Or in other words, get as much out as possible. In other words, limit the necessity for follow-up.
So are you trying to push towards a higher frequency than just for discovery?
Yes. But also, for instance, for color information. This is the four follow-up.
Yeah, he wants to put the follow-up in the trade space of how you design the cadence.
Yeah. Yes. Because I think that we are really going to be limited by follow-up.
Saying somebody else is going to follow up is not going
to. That's not going to be good enough. And for instance, what we found in the Penscap variability survey, if you want not only to detect variable objects, but you want to get some idea of what the period is to some degree of confidence. And there we took a 10% confidence on a sinusoidal period, which may not be true. I mean, there are all kinds of variable objects there that are absolutely not sinusoidal in their variation. You need something like 25 observations. So 2 will get you that it's variable. 3 will show that you were not wrong with the 2. But you need something like 25 to actually get sort of a period. So try to get that in there. I think that is very important. Let's see what else I had. Limit follow-up, take out the trash, go to the colors, limit follow-up, so I think that should be the conclusion. I'm not saying that you should limit the follow-up, but I said I think you should try to limit the necessity for follow-up.
Depend on.
Of course, if you have something to, at your disposal to do all the follow-up on the telescope next door, then that's fine. But in general, that won't be the case. So one last point I wanted to make is spectroscopy. Conclusion could be no more wide field images. Because that's not what we're going to need. I think there's enough wide field images out there to pixelate the whole sky. We can make this list, we did it yesterday, with all these wide field images that are either already there or are coming within a couple of years. And then I take things like the LSST already into account. I just assume that it'll be there. And the full Pan-SARs and things like that, SkyMapper, all that thing. What we are going to be limited with is spectroscopic surveys, whether it be single object things to study nice objects in detail, or whether it be multi-object spectrographs to do a whole bunch of them. If you, for instance, look at Sloan, half of the Sloan papers is written on the Sloan spectroscopy, where they only observe 1% of all the, sort of, isn't it, 1% of all the photometric objects have been followed up spectroscopically. And so this immediately shows that the spectroscopy gets you far more physics. Of course, we all know this. If it were possible, we'd want to do spectrophotometry on all objects at all time, all sky, but we can't. But the spectroscopy is where we are going to have a crunch, basically. And especially spectroscopy on 4-meter glass telescopes. Because a lot of these surveys, existing as well as new surveys, will go to depth of, say, 21st magnitude. Of course, there will be the targeted very deep surveys that go down to 25th and 26th magnitude. But a lot of them, certainly the big ones that are going to do all sky, are not going to go that deep.
They claim that a single shot, they're going down to 24th magnitude, say for
Pan-SARs. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the survey. But, yeah. And so, I mean, with the deeper ones, of course, you need the spectroscopy on the 8 or 10 meter glass telescopes. But currently, the demand on those telescopes is still so high that I don't see it happening that one of those will be converted into a dedicated spectroscopic survey instrument. I can think of a few telescopes that would be nice to do this, especially those on not all too superb imaging sites. But I think that we'll see a large increase for the spectroscopic demand also on 4-meter glass telescopes, or even on 2.5-meter telescopes. I mean, if you want to do a whole part of the sky. So a conclusion there might be that for galactic science, if you are still limited at high galactic latitude, which I guess is unescapable since a lot of these new surveys will be designed for extragalactic purposes, deeper is not always better, but wider is. So for instance, a survey that I like very much is the SkyMapper survey, since that is going to go to 2.5 radians.
Those last two points contradictory.
Yeah, contradictory.
No, you mean no more wide field settings?
Wider is better.
Wider is better, but do it with the existing images. Okay.
Stop spending money
on building imagers. But actually put that into convincing your whatever allocational board, observatory board, to put a good spectrograph on these telescopes.
But you're saying basically after this next round, which is in the works, the Pan-SARs,
right, yes.
SkyMapper, let them go.
Let them go, of course, they will go. That's great.
Next?
Exactly.
No, I think the problem is during Pan-STARRS there's going to be an issue with spectroscopy. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is the problem. It's 5 years, but this is a problem. It's 1 year.
Yeah, we have to start worrying about this now, because I mean. There, of course, there are good spectrographs out there. Yeah? There are good multi-object spectrographs out there. There are good single-object spectrographs out there. But there's not going to be enough, because the demand for them will go up very quickly as soon as all these surveys start to produce results.
Yeah. But we also know, right, that as you're saying, that because most of them are quite wide surveys, that multi-object spectrographs are not going to help you.
No, exactly. So you need both. You need both. Eh? You want to do the multi-object spectrograph where you want to study real big populations. Yeah, of galaxies or stars or whatever, yeah? But certainly for the strange surveys, yeah? And also for things like clone, yeah, that we are studying, the oddballs, the rare ones out. Yeah? The AMCDNs are one in a million, or one in a family.
For transients, you need some pointed single slit thing, but if you want to look at variables, and they're going to be there for a while, you can identify them over several years, and then there might be a high enough density that you can do the
there might be a high enough density. Yeah? But then you always have to come up with a composite science case where you say, okay, in this field, I'm going to look at the RLIRA in the halo, the dwarf novae close by, the transiting exoplanets, whatever, all at the same time with multi-object spectrograph. Yeah? So for identification, for instance, multi-object spectrographs are, of course, great. Yeah? If you say, okay, I'm just going to do a spectroscopic survey of the sky, which is actually something that I'm waiting for. I mean, this would be great. I mean, we're doing all this photometry. Yeah? Soon we'll have it. Well, we'll have a billion objects or more, 2 billion objects, where we have positions, we have colors, we have time variability information. But, I mean, a spectroscopic survey would be great. Now, Gaia is going to do this for a couple million objects down to 17th magnitude in a very tiny spectral window. Yeah? But what I think would be the next step, if we want to think about this, is to do an all-sky spectroscopic survey. It will take a lot of time. You need a great multi-object spectrograph.
I would say only build multi-object spectrograph. It's like, you know, why build a narrow field imaging if you want? Not for everything you need it, but for a lot of things you will be more efficient if you have one.
I mean, there are
it depends if you can combine science cases.
Right.
Yeah? But if you say, okay, we have this population of objects that have a surface density, say, lower than 1 per square degree, which you can identify quite a few populations that have a surface density lower than that, then if you say, okay, I want to study these in detail, you don't need a multi-object spectrograph.
No, but you're probably better off the larger picture of all these surveys coming online and providing the same kind of wide field of view. So the grid will contain tons of variables, transits, all sorts. You know, if you want to characterize those, the density is very quickly high enough.
I mean, there are baryon acoustic oscillation surveys that, you know, you sort of base this on the supernova stuff, but there are baryon acoustic oscillation surveys that aren't going to cover huge amounts of sky, but they are going to be spectroscopic multi-object things that, and, you know, they're going to go after certain classes of objects because they have an efficiency they want to do.
Right.
But you might want to talk to them about putting a few slits on other things.
Yeah. Oh, that's another point. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that, Peter.
That was a song one. There's several others as well. I think the Javi Everly is going to be a large catch in the sky as well. And there's the JDAM supernova thing might end up just being spectroscopic in both Destiny and Adept.
That would be great. But the point that I forgot to put down is homogeneity. I mean, just putting a few fibers when something is left over on interesting targets is a great way of finding a few objects. It's horrible if you want to do population statistics on that. And because you have to figure out what the selection criteria were. And that is difficult unless you do major fractions. So homogeneity in all these surveys is extremely important so that we can actually figure out what the selection criteria were and what the observing efficiency was and how much sky you effectively covered and things like that.
Are grisms too coarse to do things like this?
Well, you're talking about slitless, objective prism plates and things like that. No, that is a possibility to do it, but you'd rather go to a little bit higher resolution than just a few hundred to be able to do these things.
Sky background. So,
yeah.
Well, what would be the strategy then? I mean, we are going to have PanSTAR as an LSST, and I know we tried to address that, Bob tried to address that in his talk. What would be the discovery rate for supernovae? But it's something like thousands per year, right?
Right.
And the similar thing we face for lensing, which is the other thing that I'm interested in. So now you have this discovery rate. You don't always know the first or second time you look what you have, but at some point
thousands
in time,
per year?
You have a great...
Of what?
Well, I'm not sure. What was it about the type 1A supernovae? Was it 1,000? It was actually a very high rate.
For by survey, yeah. I mean, once per week or once every 4 days, as far
around
as
that, yeah.
The stupid last year.
Of type 1A supernovae, but yeah, transients and other variables, it's going to be
thousands
per day.
Right, so I guess there's a practical question that I just wanted to ask you, which is this. Which you make even worse, okay, you make the urgency of it even more, which is how do you decide what to look at next? I mean, spectroscopy you want for some of these, for some classes of objects you really want good astrometry all the way to see, you know, where the relative positions of a couple of things might be. What is the, suppose you were in charge of PanSTARs or LSST and you had the follow-up resources at your fingertips, what kind of a system would you design that could maximize the things that need quick follow-up, either with spectroscopy or astrometry? How would you design it?
Oh, that's an extremely difficult question for Sam.
Yeah, how much money do we have available?
On the basis of what on the basis of what he has just written there,
mm-hmm.
you have to prepare filters based on the time evolution and the colors. I mean, I don't think
I would agree with you.
Any other? Way to go out.
Yeah. Indeed. So colors and time variability.
Time evolution.
Time evolution. Yeah.
And after that. And you can just do a first rough selection of what you believe to be interesting and what does it.
Yeah. And try to be systematic in this. So, I mean, not just say, okay, whenever I have a fiber left on my 6.5 meter telescope with 600 fibers, instrument that I use continuously for this, because you said that I have the resources.
That's right.
But to say, okay, I'm going to do these,
maybe 1 in 10 of them or 1 in 100 of them, but try to get that consistently, which is going to be difficult. It's going to be a nightmare.
In a decision beforehand, you would say, I'm going to think that certain types of objects I can see.
Yeah.
I think much of your
question actually comes back to this point here. Get as much out of the survey itself as possible. Because this will...
Spectroscopy you're not going to get.
But at least
then you will have the information on colors, on time variability, to try and make a distinction beforehand. Okay, say we spend so much time on supernovae. So you can already identify those from the survey itself. Or we say, okay, no, we're not interested in supernovae 1As, we're interested in supernovae 0.1As, which are going on faster. So you can get that already from the survey itself. So this, I mean, also to prevent a nightmare decision like that, okay, well, what is our selection criteria? That you can try and characterize the populations you're interested in as much as possible from the data you are going to get in anyway. I mean, the nightmare scenario is where you have a variability survey that looks at each position twice and detects lots of things, but then you have to go on and if you have the resources available, if you couple Palomar-Cranston's factory with Las Cumbres, and you say, okay, I just use Las Cumbres only for the follow-up, if you have those kind of resources available, then that's a possibility.
Yeah.
But in general, I think that will not be the case.
But you can have it with a type 1 identification without spectrum. I mean, you just see the light curve. And you
have to ask the supernovae people.
It's a good question. There's quite a bit of controversy on it. And we just saw that we can't even trust spectra, so.
I guess it's the same question as asking, okay, do you want to do a redshift survey with only photometric redshifts? I don't know. Techniques are good enough. I mean, we're looking into Sloan for D-test red dwarf, white dwarf binaries. We're trying to characterize them on the photometry alone without any spectroscopy. It works, but to a certain accuracy. So it depends on what you want. But I really see that the spectroscopy is going to be a crunch.
No, I appreciate what you're saying here.
Thanks.
But I think that the RA deck magnitude and cadence volume is so huge that you really have to decide on the experiments you want to do. And yes, if there's some way of extracting other information out of that, that's great.
No, I agree with you, Peter. That of course every survey will have its goals.
I mean, I was on the science advisory committee for the LSST,
right.
And I went in there thinking, okay, we're going to get the whole sky and every color every 3 days, and it is not true because. You just, you know, some people want to look at asteroids, and that's even a different filter in different parts of the sky. And in the end, it was that supernovae have to be done in some percentage over some part of the sky. And everybody has to, you know, design the experiment.
I agree. I agree that it would be great if we don't have to do this, if we can get the whole sky in all colors all the time. Yeah, but that's then we then have to track it.
But you know, I said every 3 days. You want it every hour or every minute and a half.
But when designing these surveys, try to keep an open mind. Yeah? That there might be other people interested in the products you are going to deliver as well. For instance, this point on how low can you go, I think that's a major thing. That if extragalactic surveys were to be pointed at a slightly lower galactic latitude, this would already be enormous help for galactic astronomy. Because with the current system, with Sloan 1, we are already basically volume limited.
Well, Sloan 2 has a Segway component that goes to lower latitude.
That's great.
And we actually go to 30 degrees galactic latitude in our supernova search because we have to.
I'm not saying that it's not happening, but I think
that's easier to see the data.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. All right. I don't know if there's any other points.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. So Lars, over to you.
Do you have any energy left? Or?
Okay, Lars. We have not even talked about our radio surveys.
That's true. I mean, that's in the new movement.
I want to do the audio. Who said discovered in the audio the other day?
That was good. Discovered in the audio.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, so, it was actually, wasn't it? I mean... audio video.
So what I want to do is, I've been a little bit obsessed the last month or two with trying to understand whether or not these 0.1A should be seen in any of the surveys. And so that finally drove me to understand a little bit better the loss. If you have a poorly cadenced survey, what's the loss in the rate? You know, if your cadence is not optimal. But the inverted case is, how do you calculate the optimal cadence? So I just want to walk that through. The other thing I had never seen was the measure everybody uses for whether your survey is any good is A omega. And actually, I'll show you that that's actually not the case.
People with good A omega use that.
That it's actually A omega over the seeing that matters for a supernovae survey or any kind of transient survey. And so I'll derive that for you. And then I'll actually show you a little bit on these optimal cadences if you want to do discovery. And I presume this is what everybody does before they go out and do a survey. I'm presuming they just don't tell anybody, but they've done this exercise. So I'm sure none of the observers are going to learn anything from this, but since it's been driving me crazy, let me show you how to do this. So imagine you have some event out there which has some rate per unit volume, this is called R, which looks like that. So that's just some rate of something, okay? And you're giving me a telescope with some area A, some omega of the camera, solid angle of the camera, okay, and of course some flux, typical flux per square arc second from the sky, which is side by hand. All right. So what I want to do is I have a few variables at my beck and call. I have the exposure time. Okay, that's one variable I can optimize. And I have what I call the cadence time. So these are my two variables. I'm free. Once you've given me the telescope forever with these parameters, these are my two variables. And now what I want to do is show you the optimization scheme for exposure time. Is pretty obvious, but I'll walk you through it for those who haven't seen it. And then the cadence time, I'll show you the result of the cadence time optimization. And of course, this depends on what you're searching for. Right? So this really depends on the light curve as a function of time. Let's just call it L of T. Whatever it is, your L of T is.
There should be an overhead or bin time or something.
I'm a theorist.
The switching time.
Right? Yeah.
Ideal case.
Yeah. Right. So what I want to derive is something that I can use if you give me these parameters. And if somebody, this will be, in my theory, this should be the upper limit to what you can detect. Right? I'm hoping to calculate something that's so good that no experiment can exceed it. Right? Okay. You see the exercise. Okay, so how do you do this? So you run your survey for some time t. So just think t is, 100 years. Doesn't matter. So some long time. Right? So run t for much, much longer than the cadence. Right? So think of that. That means that in my survey volume, I'm going to detect up to some volume every event. Right? It doesn't, it's going to happen. The event duration is going to be shorter than t. Okay? So the duration of the event is shorter than t. Right? So I'm going to do the easy case. So type 1a in a year. See, this is easy. Okay? Okay, so how many do I detect? So n is the number of events I detect. Let me back up. So the omega of the survey, right, is clearly just omega of my camera, right, times the cadence divided by the exposure time. Okay? So I, no day, night, we can always go and put the factors in two. Okay? That I just am running this thing nonstop. So that's the omega of my survey. It's the cadence divided by the exposure. That's how many images I get of the sky. Okay? So in some time t, the number of events then is omega of the survey, right, divided by, let's put it in 4 pi units, right? So omega over 4 pi, right? The time I've run times the rate, right? And then just 4 pi d cubed, 4 pi over 3 d cubed. Right, where D is my survey limit, distance. Right, so, everybody agree? Okay. All right, so the number per unit time, which is what we're going to optimize, right? That's what we want to optimize.
D is your survey distance.
Yeah.
Do we know what that is?
I'll get to that. Right, so the number, I just want to get my initial formula. So this is then just going to be TC over TE. Omega of the camera, R, 1/3 d cubed. Okay? So that's the number per unit time I can detect. All right, so hopefully everybody agrees with that. I'm waiting for the observers to set me straight. Okay. Well, so what's the volume? What Roseanne is asking, right? Well, that's just going to be b cubed, is, of course, something which I'm going to call bracket L, which I will have to define in a minute, divided by 4 pi times the minimum flux. All to the 3. That's right? That's the d cubed. Okay. So this L, I'm going to put a little subscript on it, will depend on my cadence. Okay, and I have to define that. You can think of that naively. You can say, well, if my cadence is really, really, really short, then that's the peak luminosity. Right? If my cadence is very long and I miss the event, then I've got to calculate this thing. So this thing, as we'll see in a moment, is something that I have to calculate. I have to know the light curve. But it's the luminosity on the cadence time scale. And I'll show you how I calculate that in a minute.
The exposure time?
No, that's F min.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So you want to take the minimum lights?
Not there yet. Sorry. So first you just...
Okay.
There is a characteristic luminosity of a given event given the cadence. And I'll have to define it. Okay? Okay, so let's just keep going. So then this n over t, right, is going to be equal to tc over te omega cr 1/3 by l 3/2 4 pi f min. 3/2. Okay, so now I have to optimize. So they first optimize the depth of the survey, right? Which is in F min, and the exposure time. Did everybody see that?
And you have to take FS into account there as well.
That's right. That's where it's going to come in. So F min is just whatever the survey depth is. It's not defined yet, right? But it defines my volume.
Yeah.
Okay. But I haven't optimized over it. Okay, so let me just write it out this way just so you can see it. So the point is, there's another thing I'll optimize later, which is this L to 3/2 times the cadence. Does everybody see that? So there's another variable I have to optimize, but I'll do that next. So there's this L, which does depend on the cadence, times T.
I'm a little confused about that L depending on the cadence, though. I mean, if you have a case, consider any kind of an event or light curve,
yeah,
and now you've assumed that you're looking over time that's much, much larger than the cadence.
Well,
so,
no, I don't know yet whether my cadence. If you give me a light curve, I will calculate for you, and I'll show you that. Mm-hmm. The optimum cadence to maximize this quantity.
I mean, essentially, wouldn't that optimum be the optimum such that you really are depending only on the average? That's what I'm saying, is that if you sample this thing enough times, and assuming it's not a unique type of event,
sure,
or types of events. Then you just, you're going to catch them at any arbitrary point,
Well, I think the simple point is the following. So let me make the simple statement. I'm desperate to quantify the loss of events due to a really poor cadence. Okay, so I have to write down a formula and I have to calculate something. So this is the formula so far. This is fine so far. And I'll
do the next step.
I'm just wondering whether there's
the intuition's simple. For type 1A, 15 days is optimal. But how many are you losing if you do a 1-day cadence? That's what you can't tell me, I don't think. If you do a 1-day cadence supernova survey, you're not getting anywhere near the maximum discovery rate. How bad have you done? I don't think you can tell me that.
Only if that comes at the expense of area. I mean,
No. Okay, I'm going to move on. Okay. All right. Okay, that's why we're doing
equations.
Multivariables are real. Okay, so this thing goes like 1 over TE.
But it's clear that you're only interested in discovery rate, right?
No, not yet. No. I have to define what's going to... I'll get there. You tell me the sign so I can run it. Okay. All right.
So this is the quantity. Normally the other way around, isn't it?
I first want to optimize, right? Which is this 1 over the exposure time times the F min to the 3/2, this variable. This is just going to set my exposure depth, right? Okay, so you'd say, let's go to short exposures. But this looks nice. This 1 over T, of course. That looks good. So let's first do short exposures. Right? Well, short exposures, of course, for short exposures, the minimum flux, right, is roughly just 1 over the area times the exposure. Right? Signal to noise just goes like time. Okay? So just think of this flux as, this is photons per second per square centimeter. Okay? So if I put that in, then at short exposures, I get that n over t is proportional to t e to the 1/2. Okay? Does everybody see that? So that makes sense. That's what the observers know, which is go deep. You'll go better by t e to the 1/2. Okay? Well, how deep do you go, huh?
Depending on that patch.
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. So how deep do you go? So... Right? So this is okay until you hit the sky. Okay? And then, of course, your signal to noise goes like the area times whatever you're going to call the minimum flux times TE divided by the square root of noise in the sky, which is area times FS times TE. Right? So if I play that through, right, then I get F, sorry. Then I, for that case, right, I get F min is, of course, FS over ATE to the 1/2. Okay? And so if I go back to this figure of merit, this quantity, okay, there's two limits for this. So 1 over TE, 1 over F min. So the 3/2 has two limits, one where it goes as area to the 3/2 times TE to the 1/2. That's in the short exposure limit. And the other limit, this goes to, I'm saving you some algebra, A to the 3/4 divided by T exposure to the 1/4, FS to the 3/4. So the curve, right, which is the number of discoveries per unit time, which looks like T to the 1/2.
Infer there's a maximum limit.
And then 1 over T to the 1/4. Sorry?
Yes.
What happened?
No, I was saying that we're going to infer there's a maximum.
Yeah. Right? Hopefully I did my algebra right. I've done it twice, so it might be true. Okay?
So where's the optimum? Well, duh.
The observers will say, gee, Lars, it's cute to watch you derive what we all know. Okay? That's the optimum. It's just sky limited. You just expose to your sky depth. Okay? That's the minimum, but it's a pretty weak minimum, actually. So you can be really sloppy, because this is 1 over T to the 1/4. You don't have to be that smart. Right, you can go deeper than the sky if you want, but you're not helping a lot. You might fool yourself, oh, I'm going to do so much better if I expose deep. Not true. Right? This is not going to help you at all. Okay. Or the other way, you don't lose too much, but it's pretty weak. Okay? Does everybody see this? So you just expose to the sky depth. But there's twos and pi's and square root of fives and stuff, but I'm not worried about that. So now let's put in, go back to this formula. It's kind of hard to read here. And put in now the optimum for TE and Fmin. Does everybody see that? So let's go at the optimum. So at optimum, right? Then, of course, Fm is the sky. You expose to the sky depth. And TE is that mess, 1 over A F sky. Okay, and so this formula then becomes TC omega C R over 3.
That's L to the 3/2. A, all divided by FS to the 1/2.
So that's the first optimization. So let me just write that down over here, because here's the A omega just got derived for you, if you didn't see it. Right? So this says that it's proportional to A times the omega of the camera divided by the flux of the sky to the 1/2. That's the figure of merit, not A omega. Okay? And so this is where the scene comes in, obviously. Because it's 92 per square meter. Okay?
And dual color band as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's all that. All that's there, implicitly, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a filter above it, but that's not... I was doing the algebra, okay? So this has been driving me crazy because I can never find a derivation of A omega. It's probably some, again, I'm waiting for somebody to say, don't you know, Lars, it's in this paper. Nobody's saying that, okay? Peter, I'm just waiting for Peter. These guys have done supernova surveys for 20 years. Okay, so this is a figure of merit. Right? Okay.
Something we know by experience, we never calculate.
Okay. So what is remaining is this thing that Roseanne was asking me about, which is another piece I have to still figure out, which is this TC L to the 3/2. Right? So I have another variable still free, which is the cadence. Okay? So how do I do that? All right.
And this is where I have to add something, which is these supernova searches, because they're rolling searches,
Yep.
Have their follow-up at the same time.
Yep.
So
yep.
this is just for the discovery thing.
Right. No, I haven't said that yet. I've not said that yet.
We have a shorter cadence than optimal for supernovae.
I haven't defined L yet.
We're trying to get the light curves.
I understand. Okay, let me define L. Okay. I have not defined L. Okay. So now I'm going to define L, because you're forcing me to do it. Okay? So let's take a sample. Let's say what our target is. Right? So now we have to decide what we want. So let's do type 1. Okay? So here's what I did, just to get some intuition. So I take a linear light curve up to max at Tm. Okay? I mean, this is just to write some formula down. And then an exponential decay. So this is e to the minus t over tau after maximum, and this is just linear. Okay, so that's the light curve that we know. Okay? And we know the peak, of course. L not. All right. So now the question is, what do you want to do for your survey? So now you can tell me what you want. Because the only variable remaining is the fact that the start times will occur randomly within your cadence. Okay, so the only remaining variable that I have to integrate over is when does the supernovae occur in relative to the phase of your cadence.
You're assuming that tau is a constant.
I'm sorry, so tau is a constant. The events are described by two variables, Tm and tau.
Right. Right. For that simple model of tau.
Right? I don't know what you're asking. Tau is constant over my survey time.
Well, if you have a family of different tau values,
I can integrate over anything. Sure. Okay? So now you decide what you want. Right? So, Peter, you're saying what you want is 6 points on this curve. Okay? Fine.
6 points before one tau.
Fine. So I can go do that calculation. Okay? Right? So let me show you what I do. Right? So let's say that's what you want. You say, Lars, that's what I want. I say, okay. I can run this as a function of phase of the start time. Right? The depth of the survey will be determined by the minimum flux that satisfies your criterion. Right? So if you want 6 points before the rise, okay, then you see exactly what would happen. Actually, that you could just write down algebraically. You want to have 6 points on the cadence before the rise. Guess what? The depth of the survey is completely determined by that luminosity.
Okay.
And now I integrate over phases, and so there's a little fuzz down here, and that's this L. That's this thing. That's what you go calculate. Okay?
I mean, usually we don't want 6 points before maximum, we want 6 points over the curve.
All I'm saying is you tell me the criteria, I can do the calculation.
Right? So what did I do? Okay? So what I did, and I'll show you, and then I'll shut up. Is I wanted to detect it twice. Okay, so this is what I would call a detection survey, not a survey to do follow up within. Okay, and you can then go and do this integral. Right, so remember the integral here now is I have to integrate over the phase, the distribution of phase, which is random of course, of when the event occurs, right, relative to the cadence.
This becomes interesting when you get over on the exponential k side more than the linear side.
Yeah, so I mean there's... So first off, does everybody see the algebra? Okay.
Uh-oh.
One point.
Wow.
Sure.
You have to show the lines.
So let me just cut to the chase. Okay, so here's what you get. So the variables are the luminosity, the peak luminosity, the volume rate, that little r, Tm, the time to maximum, and tau e, the exponential e fully time. Okay? So the top line is normalized to be 1. That's the 1a's. So let's just first look at the top line. So this is cadence. And this is, you know, relative discovery rate. Okay?
And volume has nothing to do with the detectability volume at this point. So that was not folded into that at all.
No, it's there. So this is going to allow you to get relative rates right out of the survey. Okay?
This is for the special case of wanting to have two.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to see it twice. That's it. Okay? So you go to a short cadence of 2 days. So let's just look at the top solid line. That's the 1A range. Right? So first off, it tells you the optimum, the peak, is around 15 days. And if you're running a survey at a 2-day cadence, you can see you're down by, this is 0.4. Okay? And that's what it is. All right? So now I ran what I'm going to call my 91BG. The first ask, given a cadence, what would be the relative rates? So I made 91BG half as luminous as a typical 1A. Probably not, right? Sorry. Yeah, half as luminous. So I could run this. You can change the numbers. At 50% of the rate of 1As per unit volume. Okay? They have a rise time of 12 days and an e-folding of 12 days. So I'm trying to make them shorter. Okay? So that's what you would get for the rate. All right. So if you're running, so the point is, the first point to realize is that the rate of discovery within the survey is just the ratio of these two numbers at a fixed cadence, right? So SDSS is running at what? 2 days, roughly.
Every 2 days, with weather thrown in, probably closer to every 3 days.
3 days. So the point is, if you had a volume rate of 50%, but the point one, because this is what's been everybody keeps hammering me with, is why haven't we seen them? So I ran a 0.1 at 0.2 peak luminosity, okay, so down by a factor of 5.
7% of the volume rate,
thanks to my friends here. Right, 5-day rise, 5-day equal. There's the number. Okay, so in SDSS, if this were the only thing that was happening, you would have a rate that's roughly a factor of, what am I at? Yeah, about 200. But of course, these have an additional problem, which is that they're faint enough, they also have to worry about losing them in the hosts. Whereas the 1As, you don't. You don't lose them in the hosts, typically. So that's a different piece of astrophysics one has to do. But this is to get a sense for how poor or not your cadence is, and now you can define, you can tell me, if you want 5 data points, I could, you can run it for 5. Right?
So this is what's ideal, though, for things like PanSTARRS and LSST. They're going to be right where you'd like them to be.
Well, I don't know what's short answer is I don't know. What's been uncertain for me is just what's the loss. I think the part that's easy, and I think this is what the observers do, is they say, well, we know where the maximum's gonna be. And guess what? I put in 5 and 5 and I get 5. Okay, yeah, fine.
So if you want to emphasize right. Follow up, you just increase the number of
so now I can calculate. Right, so Paul says or Peter says, we want to do follow-up within the survey. Fine. I can now tell you how many supernovae you're losing, right? So legacy survey.
Trade-off is for
yeah. So they are losing. They're losing. They're losing about a factor of 2 in their supernova rate. Because of,
but they know the ones that they get much better.
I understand. No. I'm just saying it is what it is.
At least you know what the trade-off is.
You know what the trade-off is. Yeah.
But also for your 0.1A, right? It's not really the cadence that's the limit, but right, you're not that far off from if you're using slum in general 0.1s.
Right. So in slum, so I can read it off from here.
You're only that's not really the issue at this
point. Not that it's calculated, you can say that. That's right. That's correct. But in the absence of this, you tell me how to estimate it.
Hey, you should be happy that they're doing it that 2 day or 3 day before instead of that 15 day.
Yeah,
because you were saying.
So I'm not going to be happy.
I would say that 91BG lights are fainter than half the brightness of a typical one.
Sure.
So that's why I'm showing you this, right? I want you to give me the better numbers, right? And I'll run it.
Because I think, there's interesting questions about how you cadence surveys. So I think the way to say it is the following. If you wanted to do a rate survey,
right.
If your goal was to do rates as a function of galaxy types,
yeah.
I don't think you need 6 photometric points.
But you're doing
just having
follow-up, probably not.
Yeah.
Right.
But what about the confusion with other things? I mean, if that's
It's in a galaxy. What's the confusion?
There's 4 HGVs found that way.
They're running out of the ones in the galaxy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Not we're all
over. We've got to go. Why do we not let you
find out? But the point is
there's a lot of HGVs that are out of the galaxy.
Oh, yeah. That could be. Yeah. Can you do that as well?
Okay, so I think
the other problem with the supernovae is what you've done is said how to maximize without regard to redshift, right? So,
we might want
to find supernovae at 0.5, which means we actually have to go fainter than the sky background, which makes the calculation slightly different.
Not for this, sorry. So that's what I want to make clear. Not this calculation. That's the point. There's two optimizations. Your optimization you just talked about is depth of survey. This is the cadence optimization.
Right.
So this does not change the depth of survey. That's the point.
But the previous calculation, which is where you put in the F of sky.
Correct. Right. Absolutely. That's correct. But there's two variables to optimize.
Yes.
And nominally, in the theoretical telescope, those are independent.
When you were doing the algebra, you stuck in the optimal solution for depth of survey.
Yeah.
But you're saying that doesn't change.
Doesn't change this optimization.
Those are decoupled.
So this isn't very good for 0.1As in the SDSS survey, since we will have about 300 type 1As at the end of it. And it's down by about 100 or 300.
Right. So let me tell you what happened, right? So I kept doing this through those drives. Everybody kept saying, how do you find them? And Justin did this. This is for the loss within the galaxies. Let's not worry about that for a moment. But I kept running these numbers through this. And so SDSS, that was what I took. Depth of 22, 280 square degrees every 2 days. It was 7 per year at minus 17, if I keep magnitude, minus 17. And 0.5 per year at minus 15. And you're not going to have you're not going to have a year of data, right?
Well, our first paper will be on our first year.
Right.
We'll have 3 months.
Three months of nights.
Right.
Nighttime.
Losses at the edges.
What about the
Lindzen
surveys, though? I mean, would they have seen this?
I have no idea.
They do the thing looking for short events, but we're just in the middle right now of expanding that a little bit. And I'm just wondering when you find something, is this a possible explanation? It's very difficult sometimes to tell after the fact.
I don't know the answer.
A question I have is, could 91GG like be your 0.1As? Because the nickel mass produced is on the order of 0.1.
So the reason I'm forced to say no is because everybody I've talked to is convinced that the ejected mass is 1 or above. And we do not eject a solar mass material. So no can do. I mean, maybe there's something else, but I don't. I mean, if the white dwarf's left behind and you only eject 0.1 solar masses, the light curve does not look like. I mean, I can show you, this is the stuff Dan Kaysen ran, thankfully. The top, these are nickel balls, as he called them. So 0.1 solar mass of nickel and a 0.1, so that's a solid line. That's what it would look like. I don't think that's a 91BG. So the delta M15 is about 3.
That's a pretty fast.
Right.
2 is about as fast as it could ever be.
So what we haven't run, but maybe Dan could do it just for kicks, is a 0.2, 0.2. That might start looking like a 91BG in terms of the light curve.
But Dan can get just about anything. So.
Well, I think the nice way to say it is how do we know, how do we measure from the observations the ejected mass? Okay? And the answer is twofold. One is it definitely sets the time it takes to get the maximum. Okay? That matters. That's one variable that matters. And you can sort of see that in these curves. So here's a 0.01 and a 0.1. And you see that the 0.01 gets the maximum in about 2 days, whereas the 0.1 gets the maximum in about 7 days. Okay, and square root, and it should go to square root of mass. Okay, so square root of 10 is 3, 3 times 2 is 6, it's about, it's in the ballpark. Okay, so if he went up and ran an even more massive case, this time the maximum from the day of explosion increases, that we know. So that's one way you get it, right? The other way is at very, very late times, in the nebular phase, from the optical depth arguments for the gamma rays, you basically get the ejected mass that way.
Right.
So.
And they do seem to.
Those more
VG lights do seem to decay fairly slowly.
Exactly. So these, you can see what happens is at 10 days they go optically thin to the gamma rays. So you can see that here, actually, in this guy. See how it all of a sudden plummets? That's because at this point it's already gone optically thin. So this is where the gamma ray peak. So if you could look at it in gamma rays, it would peak at 10 days. Instead of a normal 1A where it's at like 100 days. So I think that's why we can't make the VGs this way.
But you said you couldn't go any lower than 2 days.
Delta M15B, sort of, it drops off. And so for a normal, it's like 1.1. So that's the amount of magnitude that decays 15 days after maximum. Mm-hmm. And for many 1BGs, they just kind of fall off the edge there at 2. And at 3, there's almost, you know, there's not very many objects there at 3 that are supernovae.
So I think the thing that at least I now have a feeling for is this what's useful about this plot is this relative number, right? So I think that's what you can take from this. And of course, this will be a little bit worse because some of these will also be lost in their hosts. That's not in this calculation.
Right.
Okay. So.
Well, should be very sensitive, actually. I mean, they're still pretty bright. And
right here, there's the numbers. So if you do a survey with a depth of 24, that's what the plot's for. There's the 1A rate in the volume per year. That's the solid line. The solid line is just the B cubed. And then if you have 1 arc second seeing, the loss is, the line is this line, is this next line.
But how did you calculate this? By assuming, okay, so, assuming the surface luminosity of the galaxy is the same?
So we took the 0.18 to follow the K light.
Right.
Okay. So it's an old population. We made the universe, we filled the universe with L star galaxies, spectral luminosity galaxies, giving them their scale length. That gives you the surface brightness distribution. And then you demand signal noise at 1. That's what this calculation is. So this doesn't have a realistic distribution of ellipticals that says every elliptical is an L star, but you know, it's a place to start. Right?
I mean, we've not done the calculation as a function of galaxy brightness. We've thrown in fakes on galaxies and we've calculated what the losses are as a function of apparent magnitude in the survey. But we haven't done, say, you know, for a faint supernova on a bright galaxy, how much is the differential loss?
Right. So this is the differential loss assuming a delta function for a galaxy type. Right. We haven't done the calculation with a real distribution of galaxy type. So I don't have the answer for that. But it is an issue for these. So here's the, you know, so it's a factor. So you're right, when they're nearby, the loss isn't big. You're right, that's here. It's imperceptible. Right, if you're going to depth of 24, most of your rate's out there. So then it's a factor of 4. Of course, for 1A's, this is not a problem, typically. So then you get fooled. You say, oh gee, they're all outside the host. Look at that. Well, no, so that's the only place you can find them.
Any more questions or comments about either what Laura said or about the entire set of very interesting things that were presented today?
Everybody's on
there. So, thank you to everybody.